All right, so as we're resetting here, I'm just going to reintroduce our panel. My name is Kayla Eid. I am serving as presiding judge today. Welcome to the Minnesota Court of Appeals. Today is May 22nd, 2025. I'm joined by Judge Bond and Judge Riley. And this is the second of three cases on our Zoom oral argument calendar today. This is A241847, Mary J. Dykstra, respondent versus Tony Dykstra, appellant, and I apologize if I missed pronounced the name. You can feel free to correct me when you introduce your clients who you represent. The appellant will have 15 minutes for their initial argument, and the respondent will have 15 minutes for their argument, and then appellant, you'll have 5 minutes for rebuttal. This is being recorded, and it will be up on our website usually in about 24 hours from today. When you begin your argument, counsel, if you could please introduce yourself and the party you represent. With that, Mr. Webster, whenever you are ready to proceed.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court, opposing counsel. My name is Zachary Webster. I represent the appellant, Tony Dykstra, in this matter. This appeal is brought on regarding an issue of personal jurisdiction and this matter, and that the Arizona judgment in this case should be void for lack of personal jurisdiction. The district court in this case found there was no general jurisdiction, so the real issue is specific jurisdiction. There are three requirements with regards to personal jurisdiction under the Constitution of the United States that are needed for Mr. Dykstra to have specific jurisdiction in Arizona. Those are that Mr. Dykstra, the appellant, purposely availed himself to the privilege of conducting activities in the forum through the contract that he made with Paul Dykstra, which is his great uncle, his grandfather's brother, and this is brought by his estate in this matter. And the other issue that we are bringing, which is the second issue in our brief, is whether the exercise, if the court finds there is purposeful availment, that the exercises of jurisdiction in Arizona is not reasonable. The case that I think is most on point for this, for the court that we cited in our brief, is Burger King Court versus Rudizowicz. That's Rudizewicz. That's 471 U.S. 462 United States Supreme Court, 1985. In that case, it's very clear that the con just by the fact of a mere contract, there can't be personal jurisdiction, specific jurisdiction, just because there's a contract with someone in Arizona or a specific state. There are four specific elements or factors the court has to consider when looking at a contract for whether there is purposeful availment in any situation. Mr. Dykstra, the appellant, lives in Minnesota.
Can I just pause you for one second? I just want to be sure, and I think I understand this from your brief and from what you just argued, but we agree that in, or do you agree that in determining whether the Arizona court obtained personal jurisdiction over your client, Minnesota courts apply the law of Arizona as construed by the courts of Arizona? Is that right?
That is correct, Your Honor. And Arizona has as broad as possible under the United States Constitution for personal jurisdiction, which is why citing to the U.S. Supreme Court in the Burger King case is important in this case because that outlines the fullest extent of the law for personal jurisdiction.
And so then would you agree then if there is Arizona appellate precedential appellate authority that is factually analogous to this case, that would be a helpful guide at very least, if not binding, on the issue of personal jurisdiction?
I think it would be potentially a helpful guide, Your Honor, because we do have to look at this through Arizona lens. But I'm not sure it would necessarily be binding on Minnesota court, depending on what those factors are. I know we did cite some Arizona case law with regards to the reasonableness, but I think Burger King on the purposeful availment is the correct law for the court to be using.
All right, go ahead. Thank you.
And under the Burger King case, there are four factors the court should be looking at while determining whether a contractual relationship between the parties creates that purposeful availment. That's the prior negotiations between the parties, the terms of the contract, the contemplated future consequences, and the party's actual course of dealing. I think the first one, the prior negotiations of the parties and the party's actual course of dealing, are the most important in this case, as the district court made a finding of essentially an agency, as in this case, the appellant's grandfather went to Arizona and discussed this loan with the respond or
Mr.
with the
Webster, I wanted to ask you a question about the judge relying on agency law. If the grandfather wasn't an agent, what was he, and how should the judge have analyze that relationship?
The way I would look at it is he seemed more of like a mediator, or a third party. I don't believe he creates the agency, and I think there's a lack of factual, there are lack of facts with regards to the agency. As with the agency,
Ms. Dykstra talks
oh.
about how the grandfather pressured her husband into extending the loan. And
Yes, she.
that was a factual finding by the judge.
It was a factual finding, Your Honor, but I think the facts that are very lacking, especially when we're looking at personal jurisdiction, is what did Tony Dykstra do with regards to Robert Dykstra and asking him to go there? There is no facts that Tony Dykstra asked him to go there. In fact, the situation is that yes, Robert Dykstra asked him about the loan, but they brought.
Record silent because your client didn't appear in Arizona. So we don't know what happened, I don't think.
That might be correct, Your Honor, but my client doesn't have to appear in Arizona because he can appeal the personal jurisdiction issue, which is what he's doing here in this court, as he believes Minnesota is the one with proper jurisdiction in this case.
But isn't so on
Lester,
this? Oh, go ahead. No, go
go
ahead, Judge
ahead.
Bond. Sorry.
It seems significant to me that this was a loan that was solicited in Arizona from an Arizona resident. The money was extended from Arizona, and your client made a few payments to a resident of Arizona. Why aren't those facts enough for purposeful availment and reasonableness?
Well, I think part of it has to do with the purposefulness, and it gets into my second argument as well. But when you look at the four factors in this case on purposeful availment, I think those deal with the party's course of dealings and the negotiations between the party. Yes, there were some negotiations between the parties in Arizona, but the contract was drafted in South Dakota. The appellant only signed the contract in Minnesota, which there's no evidence that he discussed the contract or made any changes to that. And I think with regards to agency, Robert Dykstra didn't have the ability to sign on behalf of Tony Dykstra. I think that's also important in agency because if someone was acting as an apparent agent, they should be able to sign on their behalf. With regards to the
Oh,
course of dealings, there were some minimal payments
wait, before
to.
you get to course of dealings, I just want to ask one other question because what do we do with the fact that the check that, and I'll just use the first name, Nepal wrote, because they share the same last name, to Robert. It was written to Robert, and the notation line said loan for Tony on it. I mean, how do we interpret that fact with regard to the agency? Because that seems to be kind of a hard fact for your side of the case.
I think again, it goes towards this third party. And even if there was an agency and the court finds this agency, I don't think it necessarily shows the purposeful availment in all of this because, again, it would be an implicit agency with that. And it might be just because Mr. Paul Dykstra doesn't have an address or a checking account to give to Tony. So he felt it was easier and safer to send it to Robert Dykstra versus sending it
No
to.
dispute that the money ends up in Tony's hands, right? That's never been disputed. So, I
That's
mean,
correct, Your Honor.
it would seemingly would require us to. I mean, that just seems really tough. And I don't know. I wanted to give you an opportunity to respond to that.
I think it goes towards potentially an issue with South Dakota, and it goes towards this agency question, but it is still one factor here. And I think another factor of whether Mr. Dykstra would be expected to be hauled into Arizona is with the course of dealings. There were minimal course of dealings. It was a couple checks to Minnesota, or the check to South Dakota that was then transferred to Minnesota, as you brought up, Judge Edie, as well as a couple payments that were sent to Arizona. But otherwise, Mr. Dykstra paid some cash, I believe, was in his affidavit when Paul Dykstra came to Minnesota. And so that was payments that were done in Minnesota, not to Arizona. And so there's very minimal contact to Arizona outside of payments. And I think the terms of the contract and the contemplated future consequences don't suggest that Arizona is the proper venue when the collateral for this contract is an airplane that's here in Minnesota. The money that got sent is here in Minnesota. Mr. Dykstra, who's going to have to be sued, is here in Minnesota. Any future consequences has to be dealt with in Minnesota because Arizona doesn't have the jurisdiction to take that airplane if there is a judgment, which is why this case had to be filed in the first place. I think
Well,
all of the
you did say the money that got sent is here in Arizona. I mean, the
Or
money got sent
Minnesota.
to it, Well, you said it, yeah,
the
you said it's here in Minnesota, but the money got sent to Arizona, right? I mean,
So let me rephrase that. The money from the initial loan got the 70,000 got sent to through South Dakota to Minnesota, and then there were some minimal payments back to Arizona. I think that might have been a little confusing, Your Honor. Does that answer the question? And so I think when you look at the terms of the contract, the future consequences, and the minimal contacts that were had throughout this contract in Arizona, those three factors all suggest that he never purposely availed himself to Arizona. And I believe, again, with the agency issue, there is no, I think it's a very limited, at most, it shows some apparent authority agency, which doesn't necessarily go to a purposeful agency in this case, which I think is important when we're dealing with the contracts. An agency matters with regards to these contacts. It's certainly a factor here, but the fact that the district court could only find apparent authority and no actual explicit authority to create that agency, I think also matters with how much course of dealing he had, Mr. the appellant had with Arizona, and his purposefulness to get a contract in Arizona. The second issue is regarding the reasonableness of this case being in Arizona. And again, the majority of the factors go against it being reasonable Arizona. I recognize, as we stated in our brief, there is a presumption of reasonableness if the court finds purposeful availment. We believe the court shouldn't, but I think in order to get to the reasonableness question, the court does have to find purposeful availment, as the purposeful availment, if there is none, would end the argument there. And the first factor is really the only factor that would essentially be in the respondent's favors because of purposeful interjection. And for the court to find purposeful availment through this agency, that would be the only thing that would suggest some purposeful interjection, which is through a agent doing an agreement and then a contract signed in Minnesota, sent to Arizona to be signed, and then some payments sent to Arizona. There's still very minimal interjection into Arizona, but there is some under that first element. However, the remaining six elements don't go in the respondent's favor, they're actually in an appellant's favor with regards to the reasonableness of this case. The burden of the defendant going to Arizona when he had the only connection he would have is Paul Dykstra, who would be the one suing him in Arizona. He has no relation to Arizona. He hadn't been there since 2018. There's no connection there. So there's a large burden on him having to go to Arizona to defend the case. It does conflict with Minnesota, who has control over the airplane here, which is the third factor, where they have to get their judgment certified here in Minnesota to do anything with any sort of Arizona judgment. Arizona's interest, we believe, is very minimal because this is just a interfamily relationship. This isn't a large contract. This isn't any sort of business. It's really just.
You don't think that Arizona has an interest in ensuring that its residents who enter into these sorts of contracts don't end up defaulted upon by the person that they've contracted with, including family members?
I think the state obviously has some interest, as there are laws for them to bring a case there, but I don't believe it is a large interest that would say that they have that it would be they're the biggest interest in resolving this dispute. I think there's some intent that every state wants to ensure that there's fair practice within their contracts and courts. However, I think it's when it's dealing with family members, especially a situation as in the facts here, a contract that was signed in 2014, there's minimal payments but no action taken for 7 years, where it seemed the respondent was not interested or that interested in trying to collect on the judgment. I don't believe Arizona has a large interest with regards to that factor. With regards to the efficient resolution of the controversy, clearly Arizona isn't the most efficient. We're here at this case because of how inefficient Arizona is. The judgment.
That's it is efficient for Ms. Dykstra, who's now a widow.
It's a little bit more convenient for her, which would be the sixth factor. However,
Well,
it's
not
not a.
just a little bit more convenient, way more convenient. There's
Oh.
no record evidence that she comes up to Minnesota.
But in order for her to collect on any judgment she gets in Arizona, she has to come to Minnesota. To get the collateral, she has to enforce the judgment in here in Minnesota. She always was going to have to come here in Minnesota. So it's not convenient, actually, for her to do the initial case in Arizona and then still have to come in Minnesota to try to fight and get any of the collection from a judgment. That isn't an efficient resolution to this case.
Well, I assume that Mr. Solomon will have a response to that statement.
But I mean, it's why we're here is because of how inefficient it is. We first have to go through a case in Arizona, then a case through Minnesota to determine whether there was even personal jurisdiction and to collect anything on that case. Certainly, it is convenient for the plaintiff to go to her home state in Arizona to bring the case, but it's not convenient when she still has to come to Minnesota to actually get any of the benefit.
If I take your argument, spin it out, are you saying that your client agrees that he owes the 66 some thousand dollars to Ms. Dykstra and that all she needs to do is sue him here and he'll pay it, or she can collect the collateral, or what exactly are you arguing is her?
With regards to that, my client is not in agreement that he owes the $66,000. That's getting into the merits of this case. That's not why we're here. My client is saying that he never had, there was no jurisdiction in Arizona. This case should have been litigated in Minnesota, where then he would provide all of his witnesses and evidence in his defense for what that amount should have been. But that's getting to the merits. That's not why we're here today. It's to determine if Arizona had jurisdiction in this case. And it's because Arizona doesn't, with regards to the last factor, with regards to reasonableness, obviously Minnesota is an alternative forum. So there is that existing alternative forum for Ms. Dykstra. So even if the court were to find purposeful availment, there is Arizona was not a reasonable jurisdiction in this case. And so the court should still find there was no specific personal jurisdiction. Because there's a lack of personal jurisdiction in Arizona, the Arizona court's judgment should be void. And we're asking the court to dismiss this matter as well. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Webster. Mr. Solomon.
Thank you, Your Honors. May it please the court. Robert Dykstra was an agent of Tony Dykstra's. And
Can you just state that, just to, for the record, your full name and who you represent?
I'm sorry. Greg Lewis Solomon, I represent Mary Dykstra, the respondent.
Thank you.
Robert Dykstra was an agent of Tony Dykstra's. The check that was written by Paul Dykstra was made out to Robert Dykstra. Arizona has an interest in Mary Dykstra being paid what she is owed, and it is convenient for and efficient for Mary Dykstra. It was convenient and efficient for Mary Dykstra to sue Tony Dykstra in Arizona.
Mr. Solomon, other than the memo line on the check, what are the facts that you're relying on to show an agency relationship?
The facts are contained in the statement of facts in my client, the respondent's brief. The second paragraph of the statement of facts in February 2014, Robert Dykstra came to Arizona to stay with Paul Dykstra and the respondent. On this visit, Robert Dykstra came out with an agenda, and it was to persuade Paul Dykstra to lend Tony Dykstra $70,000 so that appellant could begin a crop dusting business. In prior phone calls, Robert Dykstra had mentioned to Paul Dykstra that appellant wanted to start a crop dusting business. During the February 2014 visit, Paul Dykstra and Robert Dykstra did a lot of talking about the loan. Paul Dykstra was hesitant to lend the money to appellant, but Robert Dykstra persuaded him to do so by telling Paul Dykstra that Robert Dykstra would write up a contract when he returned home. Robert Dykstra told Paul Dykstra that he was certain that appellant would pay the $70,000 back to Paul Dykstra. Those facts are all contained in the affidavit of Mary J. Dykstra, dated May 10, 2024, which is document index number 35. That affidavit proves that Tony Dykstra's brief, the appellant's brief, is factually not accurate and not true. Appellant's brief, principal brief, it's labeled, in the statement of facts reads, quote, Tony Dykstra, appellant Tony Dykstra, never, ellipsis, did any business in Arizona, close quote. Appellant obtained a $70,000 loan from his great uncle and aunt in Arizona to begin a crop dusting business. If that is not doing business in Arizona, I do not know what is.
Can I ask you, in the record, is it undisputed that Robert drafted the actual contract?
Yes.
And then what do you point to in the record that shows that? I mean, it doesn't seem like the appellant has disputed that Robert drafted the contract.
I agree.
But is there actual evidence in the record aside from the district court's memorandum? I mean, the district court's memorandum actually doesn't seem to spell that out precisely. That it says that Robert persuaded Paul to lend the money, and then Paul was hesitant, but Robert convinced them, saying he would write the contract up. And then the next part of the order describes the terms of the contract. So I guess it's left to an inference there that Robert's the one who drafts it, but that seems to be a helpful fact to your side. I just don't know that it's fleshed out in the same way that the actual check is, you know, where that shows that this on the note line. So I don't know if you can point me to any other evidence on that issue.
I would point to the affidavit of Mary J. Dykstra, document index number 35, and paragraph 4 of it. But you know, she observed all of this happening. She observed that the piece of mail with the contract was mailed to Arizona. That fact is not in Mary J. Dykstra's affidavit, but she observed everything related to the contract. That's
Thank
all
you.
The evidence, more evidence that I have. If I may, appellant's argument section of his brief at page 8, it reads, quote, the district court abused its discretion and clearly erred by making implicit findings of fact which were never alleged or even argued by respondent Mary Dykstra, ellipsis, close quote. Please see number 4 of the affidavit of Mary J. Dykstra dated May 10, 2024, which I read to the court in response to Judge Bond's question. Then please see page 7 of the transcript from the motion hearing, where I argued, pursuant to Jurek v. Thompson, the Minnesota Supreme Court case of 1976, that Robert Dykstra was acting as appellant's agent in Arizona. The appellant's argument is factually not true. The district court did not abuse its discretion or err when it concluded that based upon all the facts and circumstances and implied agreement between Robert Dykstra and the appellant, Tony Dykstra, that it created an agency relationship. Robert Dykstra was Tony Dykstra's agent. In appellant's principal brief at page 9, it reads, quote, the only facts supporting Arizona is Paul Dykstra's address being in Arizona? Close quote. Again, the affidavit of Mary J. Dykstra, dated May 10, 2024, proves that appellant's statement is not correct. Please, again, focus on the second paragraph of the statement of facts section in Mary Dykstra, the respondent's brief. Then apply the rule from Riley v. Money Mutual LLC, the Minnesota Supreme Court decision of 2016. You, the court, must assume all of the factual allegations in the respondents, Barry Dykstra's affidavit, are true. All of the activity in the second paragraph of respondents' statement of facts section occurred in Arizona. Appellant purposely established minimum contacts with the state of Arizona for the purpose of obtaining a $70,000 loan from Paul and Mary Dykstra. Mary Dykstra's assertion of personal jurisdiction over appellant comports with fair play and substantial justice. It is also reasonable under these circumstances, and appellant's conduct and connection with Arizona are such that he should have reasonably anticipated being hailed into court in Arizona. Appellant had sufficient minimum contacts with Arizona, and the district court did not err. Unless there are more questions, I waive the remainder of my time.
Thank you, Mr. Solomon. Seeing no other questions, we'll turn back to Mr. Webster. And as you begin, I want to ask you about a case. I didn't see it in the briefing, but I don't. It's totally fine if you haven't seen this case, but it's an Arizona case that seems factually similar. So, if I can ask you about this at the outset of your argument, you can let me know if you're familiar with it or not. It's called Rollins v. Vidmar. And the Pacific Reporter citation is 711 P. 2nd 633. It's a 1985 Arizona Court of Appeals case. And the reason why I want to ask you about this case is that it seems somewhat on point. The facts of it are a mother who lives in Arizona is traveling in Illinois and gets a phone call from her daughter who lives in California asking for a loan of money. The mother returns to Tucson, Arizona, and withdraws money and sends the money to her daughter and son-in-law in California, and then sends another check later. Mother claims that it was a loan. The daughter and son-in-law claim it's a gift. Eventually, the mother tries to get the money back in the dissolution proceeding in California and is unable to do so, and then files a lawsuit for breach of contract in Arizona. And the Court of Appeals reverses a trial court's decision that there was no personal jurisdiction over the California daughter and son-in-law, or at least just the son-in-law, and determines that Arizona can assume personal jurisdiction without offending due process and fair play. So the reason why I bring this up is this case isn't even... there wasn't even a trip to Arizona in that situation. The phone call was to the mother while she was in Illinois. Mother sent the money from Tucson. And so I wanted to give you an opportunity to respond to that, Mr. Webster. Go ahead.
Thank you, Your Honor. I did not see that case with regards to the briefing, so I'm not familiar with it. But based off the facts that you've provided, I think there's a very, very large distinction. And I think it's something that's getting overlooked in this case. And that is, what did appellant do? In the case that you cited, and I'm sorry I missed the names, but in the case that you cited, it was the daughter who actually called. She was actually the one purposely availing herself to get the contract. She was the one that actually did the act to make sure she got the loan. In this case, there's nothing in the record, which is why, as we cite, there's nothing that there's an agency relationship in the record or an actual agency relationship. You can only go on an implicit agency basis, as there's no facts that appellant talked to Robert Dykstra to get this loan. There's no fact that he requested this. The only facts that exist is after the Robert Dykstra went to Arizona, he drafted the contract and then sent it to Tony, who then agreed to take on the loan. So it was after all of those things that he took to do it. He didn't re There's nothing in the record here that he actually requested in that. And I think that's a very, very large distinction when we're talking about purposeful availment, because purposeful availment suggests that there's an intention to avail yourself to Arizona here. The daughter intentionally reached out to the mom in the case that you're citing, intentionally did it again when she was in Arizona to get that loan. In this case, there's nothing in the record that appellant actually intentionally did those things. And I think that's a very, very large distinction and why there is no personal jurisdiction. The court is relying on an implicit agency argument. The district court relied on an implicit agency argument to make this personal jurisdiction. But Mr. Dykstra has to have purposely availed himself, made it so he thought he would get hailed into the court in Arizona. That means that he would have had to been the one to request his grandfather, Robert Dykstra, to do that. There needs to be a factual basis for that purposeful availment that is just lacking in this record. The record suggests maybe this implicit agency agreement, maybe there's something there because of what Robert Dykstra's position was here, but it doesn't include Tony Dykstra at all until he signs the contract. That's the only information that we get with regards to Tony Dykstra, is that he signed the contract that was drafted by Robert Dykstra. There's nothing in the record about when those agreements occurred and that he purposely requested himself to be hailed into Arizona to do anything in Arizona because of that. I also would point out.
I appreciate that point. And so I guess I have two questions for you. Then, w and you don't need to agree with this, but do you think the focus of your argument rises and falls mostly on this agency point? And then I guess secondly, is it undisputed that Tony Dykstra accepted the money? I mean, that seems to be, in addition to signing the contract, the accepting the money sent from Arizona seems to be significant to me.
With regards to your second point, I think it is undisputed, as there were, as stated in the record, that there were payments with regards to the loan and he signed the contract. So I think that issue is undisputed. With regards to the first issue, I don't think it necessarily rises and falls with the agency issue. I think if there's no agency, clearly we win because there's no purposeful availment. So if the court would find that there's no agency at all, then Tony Dykstra never purposely availed himself to Arizona. So I think that's clearly where it is. But even if the court were to find some sort of agency relationship, the court can only go off of what the district court said, which is this implicit agency relationship. And then I think there's the issue of whether that, if there is an implicit agency relationship, does that still create the purposeful availment of going to Arizona in these contract negotiations, since there wasn't any actual action by Tony Dykstra and that apparent authority agency to suggest that he would have necessarily done this in Arizona, but for that there's this implicit agency relationship. I still think there's a lack of the purposefulness to go to Arizona. It was just accepting the contract that was brought to him by someone who was acting on behalf of his agency, as this court would have had to have found, but not necessarily him purposefully availing himself to Arizona. So even though negotiations might have happened in Arizona, they were between the respondent in this case and someone who is implicitly an agent, but not an actual agent. So I think that shows that the appellant didn't actually put himself in Arizona. And again, with the course of dealings, there were minimal contacts with regards to just payments that went back and forth. And I think those constitute minimal contacts. Are there any other questions by the courts? Oh, and I guess the one other issue I wanted to raise was on the respondent brought up page 9 of our brief with regards to the only issue being the address in Arizona. That was with reference to the terms of contract. The contract in this case does not reference Arizona at all, except for the address of Paul Dykstra. With that, I have nothing further, and we ask the court to remand. Thank you.
Thank you, both counsel, for your helpful arguments. The matter is deemed submitted. We will issue an opinion in the statutory timeframe.
Thank you.
Thank you.